This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. The last year has shown us just how deep healthcare disparities can be when a crisis hits. And in America's correctional facilities, COVID-19 has hit hard. More than 392,000 incarcerated people have tested positive since March. And those are just the ones we know about. Many more cases have gone unreported. So what's it been like inside correctional facilities over the last year? What precautions have been taken? And as the vaccine rollout ramps up nationwide, how accessible has vaccination been to one of our most vulnerable populations? We put those questions to Chris Roy. He's currently serving a life sentence in Mississippi, and he started by taking us back to March 2020 when he was in the Mississippi State Penitentiary, often referred to as Parchman Farm.
I was in Unit 29 in Parchman, maximum security, and at the time, it was an enormous time of change. There was a string of killings that started in December that carried into January, and then we had a new commissioner that took over. So they were shutting down buildings and sending guys out, and then everything went to a standstill when COVID hit. And so we had all this panic and anxiety build up in guys from all of this mess, and then here comes COVID. And so we're watching it on the news. You know, I had Good Morning America with their, the COVID numbers and everything's emphasized and blood red, you know, danger. And, you know, guys are upset about it. This is a facility that's known for neglecting prisoners with medical issues. If you have a broken leg or any kind of serious problem, they'll probably just give you ibuprofen and send you back to your cell. So that was the environment I was in when COVID hit.
How much communication was there from prison staff about what was happening with the pandemic?
Well, the staff in Parchman, it was really, at the time, it was really fortunate for us that we had a new commissioner and we had Rock Nation lawsuit that just happened, and they're representing us and putting a lot of pressure on the staff and administration to do their jobs. So they were more professional that time than they usually were. So we had that was very fortunate. So they were passing out masks and talking about quarantine, we're on lockdown, no transfers, no visitation, and that sort of thing. But they were more active at the time, but it was really because of the new commissioner and the Rock Nation lawsuit.
And this is an attorney that was hired by Rock Nation, which is owned by the rapper Jay-Z. And they hired this attorney to represent some of the people who are incarcerated at Parchman Prison to push them to provide better health care and improve conditions there. Chris, what's been your experience of the healthcare system in the facilities you've been in prior to the pandemic?
In Parchman, the healthcare system was just, it was very minimal, very minimal. If you had an emergency, then in the facilities I was in, it was hard to get any kind of attention. In Unit 32, Unit 29, it was, you can beat and scream and kick the door and nobody would come and see what you needed. It's one of the reasons those facilities were closed. Unit 32 was closed for the enormous number of deaths, for the inhumane conditions, and ACLU eventually got it shut down in 2010. And so they put everybody in Unit 29, and then it was just a repeat, the same thing. Killings, deaths, suicides, drug problems, contraband, corruption, and then end of 2019, it was too much. The governor, he issued an order to close the facility. He started moving guys, and then COVID hit. So, the facilities I've been in, they are notorious for very poor medical care. They're understaffed. They don't have a lot of money and that sort of thing. That's understandable to a certain point.
What about conditions in general, like hygiene and sanitation?
Again, that's part of the problem, why those places were shut down. It goes in cycles. So and it's usually a lawsuit like what Rock Nation is doing now that pushes them into doing the right thing. And so things get better for a while, maybe 1-2 years, 3 years tops, and then it goes right back to the way it was. And then another lawsuit comes, and then it goes in a cycle again. So just basic things like, you know, the officers are supposed to issue chemicals from cell to cell so guys can clean their sink and toilet and anything else. It's very hard to get that done. And it just comes down to poor management, really. The other facilities I've been in are much better. That Parchman is just a terrible place.
Well, and you are in a different facility now. What precautions have they taken to protect you from the pandemic?
So I left Parchman October last year, and I was transferred to Tallahatchie. And it's a much cleaner facility, much more professional staff. And they put us in quarantine 14 days. And the procedure went well. You know, they put everybody that came in on the zone, and we had to wear a mask if you were coming out in the hall for any reason. If you wanted to go to the front of the zone and get your canteen order, you had to wear a mask. So they were good about that. The only flaw in the quarantines, and this is for all the prisons, they're all doing the same thing. They'll have one zone dedicated to quarantine. And if you are coming in the facility or leaving out the facility, you have to do 14 days there. And so I noticed that, you know, guys that were about to leave quarantine that had done their 14 days, they would be just about to leave and another group would come in and they're just getting there. And we're all out on the zone together. So if they had something, they could have infected the guys leaving with it, you know? So it was no real isolation. The quarantines are flawed in that way. Other than that, where I'm at now, you know, they make you wear a mask in the hallway. And when we go to eat lunch in the chow hall, they have a bottle of chemicals. They sanitize. They spray your hands when you walk in the door. They're pretty good about that here. They do not issue new masks like they should. And there's no testing for COVID. The guys are, you know, they're sick and there's no testing.
Now, I understand you received your COVID-19 vaccine this week. What was that moment like for you?
It was kind of funny, actually. My roommate was skeptical of getting the shot, and he asked the nurse, you know, what are the pros and cons of getting this? And the nurse explained, well, everybody will get to take off their mask in, you know, visitation, and if you don't get it, you're not going to be able to come out with anybody. You'll be locked in your cell. And so and he's a barber, so he has to get out and go cut hair. And so he didn't want to lose his job. He said, all right, I'll take the shot. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so we both got it.
In general, how do the other folks you know who are incarcerated feel about the vaccine?
Most of them, not just some of them, most of them are skeptical for some reason. And, you know, they have a healthy distrust of, you know, authority and government because when the prison staff here is, and especially in Parchman, they lie all the time. The administration, they'll come in and tell everybody something, they don't do it. Whether they can't follow through for whatever reason, or they're just outright lying, it happens. And so we don't believe anything they say. And then the COVID thing, you know, there's all this terrible information and fake news going around. And guys in here, you know, there's phones, there's guys have access to social media, and they stay on Facebook, and they read that crap. And so there's conspiracy theories about, you know, they're trying to inject us with a nano tracker and, you know, and the vaccine is going to, if you get the vaccine shot, when they turn on the 5G network, everybody's going to turn into zombies. And I mean, it was madness. And so when they came around with the vaccine a couple of days ago, when they left, there was a guy on his own yelling out, "You guys don't know what you've done. If all of you guys got the COVID shot, you don't know what you just let them inject you with." He was just, you know, conspiracies. Now, yeah, so, you know, it's funny at the time, and but these guys are dead serious about it. Some of them are fighting mad about it. They will refuse, and they don't care about the consequences. They don't care about, you know, being locked down or losing visitation or if they're going to come in there and tackle them and fight them and make them take it. That's the experience.
Do you have a choice about taking the vaccine?
Yes. And I'm surprised about that, actually. I thought it would be a mandated deal because they come around every January in all facilities and give TB shots. And if you refuse the TB shot, they will send a takedown crew in your cell and tackle you and make you take it. But not this. And this is far more important.
So you have incarcerated individuals getting the vaccine. What about the prison staff? Do you know if they're getting vaccinated?
Yes, there's some that are buying into the same sort of misinformation and fake news going around, and I think that it should be mandatory for them. It's, you know, they are the carriers here. They're leaving and going, bringing stuff home, or bring it back into prison. You know, they would be the transmitters, and the consequences are unfair to prisoners that, you know, they want to get, we want to get visitation. We want education programs to open back up. We want to be able to move around and get our, rehabilitation. And so if they are refusing in mass numbers, then that's going to prolong all that. And so we want everything to get running like back to normal as soon as possible.
That was Chris Roy. He's currently serving a life sentence in Mississippi. He's been incarcerated in numerous facilities in the state over the last 21 years. We want to note that we reached out to the Mississippi Department of Corrections to respond to Chris's account and didn't hear back, but the invitation stands. Coming up, we'll go beyond Mississippi and look at COVID-19 behind bars nationwide.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
Whether you're looking to discover a new series to binge, find your next great read, or check out that movie everyone's talking about, NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast is your guide to all things entertainment. Every weekday, we keep pop culture in high spirits. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
We're talking about the COVID-19 pandemic behind bars, and I want to bring new voices in now. Dr. Homer Venters is a physician and epidemiologist. He's also a member of the Biden-Harris COVID-19 Health Equity Task Force. Dr. Venters, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Nicole Lewis. She's a staff writer for the Marshall Project. That's a nonprofit news organization covering the U.S. criminal justice system. Nicole, it's great to have you back.
Thanks for having me on.
So I want to start by getting each of your reactions to what we heard from Chris Roy before the break. And if you're just tuning in, Chris is currently serving a life sentence in Mississippi. Dr. Venters, I'll go to you first.
Yeah, I think it was really insightful and alarming. And unfortunately, it's really consistent with what I've seen across the country. I actually left my position running coaches about a year ago so I could just do COVID inspections in about 24 places around the country, jails and prisons and ICE detention. And what he observed and reported to us is really common, that people become sick with COVID without receiving care, that the basic systems of infection control and response to COVID-19 just aren't there because these systems aren't built for adequate care or certainly infection control. And so it's unfortunately consistent with what I've seen all over the country.
Nicole, what about you? What's your reaction to what we heard?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say what Chris explained is happening in Mississippi prison sounds like it's a microcosm for what's happening across the country. And one particular thing, you know, that I feel is really important to point out is that some of these issues that he raised, you know, from lack of medical care, you know, not trusting the staff, you know, dire conditions in these prisons, the COVID-19 pandemic has only exacerbated and really highlighted those conditions, right? And so the very conditions that allowed the virus to spread were happening, you know, before the pandemic started. And there have been subject of, you know, some lawsuits, like he mentioned, the Roc Nation lawsuit. But the same is true across the country.
Now, the Marshall Project has been tracking COVID-19 cases and deaths in corrections facilities since March 2020. Nicole, tell us some of your key findings.
That's right. So we're looking at about 400,000 people in prison have tested positive for the COVID-19, for the virus, and about 2,500 people have died. What we found was that states that performed very widespread testing, we could see that there was a much larger asymptomatic transmission, than previously understood. And so many systems that are only testing people who have, you know, serious symptoms like a cough, like trouble breathing, are really missing the full picture of the spread behind bars. And so, throwing out a few states that were able to do this, Michigan, Colorado, right, they're able to make better informed decisions about where to move people, how to quarantine people. And that became a really important tool for managing the pandemic behind bars.
Now, Dr. Venters, as we said, you're a physician focusing on corrections facilities. What have been some of the major takeaways for you over the last year?
Certainly, I would say that first, release has been a very effective but underutilized tool. So we knew at the beginning of the pandemic that high-risk people would be at greater risk for death or serious illness. And so prioritizing their release from correctional settings not only protects their lives because they're at increased risk of exposure behind bars, it also allows for better management of the facility inside. For everybody who's left there because of the need for quarantine, medical isolation, other types of responses that the CDC recommends. And so some county jails and in immigration detention, there has been some effective, sometimes through litigation, use of release of high-risk people who pose, you know, little or no public safety risk. State prisons and the federal prison system have lagged far behind, though.
Well, we heard from an incarcerated person at Tecumseh State Correctional Institute in Nebraska. They write, the vaccine rollout began with the staff, which makes perfect sense because inmates shouldn't be able to get it without a staff member being infected. That said, the vaccines actually began being administered on April 8th to the population. They offered every inmate cell-to-cell the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It appears that most took the opportunity, though I myself did not, as I already cleared the virus late last year when we had a large outbreak at the facility. I am also in a very low-risk category outside of being an inmate. We also got this question from one of you who tweets, what are other nations doing to limit the spread of COVID-19 among prison populations? Or is this an apples-to-oranges comparison because of the high rates of incarceration in the U.S. compared to elsewhere? Dr. Venters?
Well, I think that it is important to lay the terrain as somewhat an apples to oranges comparison because we have just woefully inadequate health care in American jails, prisons, immigration detention because we've separated it from the rest of our nation's public health and medical care systems. And what that means is we have a lot of people with chronic health problems that are poorly treated before COVID hit. So that is an important baseline deficiency. And our sick call systems are also very inadequate. But I would say that throughout, you know, across Europe, especially Northern Europe, you see a patchwork of policies somewhat analogous to what we have along the different states in this country of vaccine implementation. But it by now in the United States, the big difference is we have access almost everywhere in this country for most adults to get the COVID-19 vaccine. There are areas where it's difficult, where, you know, geography or other disparities exist. But we have lots and lots of vaccine in this country, more than in most European settings. And so there's actually no excuse for us to not provide the vaccine or offer the vaccine to every single person who's detained or incarcerated in this country.
Well, and as we mentioned, you are part of the Biden-Harris COVID-19 Health Equity Task Force. How does this issue of protecting people who are incarcerated, making sure they get vaccinated, fit in to the task force's goal?
Well, I think that, you know, I can't speak for the whole task force, but we had our first public recommendations, and they were around vaccine and vaccine access this past Friday. And so one of the comments I made, and one of the it was also in our official documents, is that these are congregate settings. When we say congregate settings in the United States, we must expressly include jails, prisons, and other carceral settings. And because governors, state by state, have actually failed to do that, have left these people who are in these congregate settings off the map, not even mentioned, it has allowed for a much later or delayed vaccine rollout. But it's not just the rollout of the vaccine to detained people. It's also that there hasn't been a statewide plan to get health staff, and correctional staff vaccinated and promote their engagement with the vaccine. So we have to establish them, and this is really part of my role in the task force to advance this idea that these are congregate settings. And so whatever science we have about nursing homes and long-term care facilities and COVID, we have to apply that to all congregate settings, including jails and prisons.
Nicole, paint a picture for us. What, and I know it varies from state to state, but just give us an understanding of the range of response we saw from states, specifically around prisons and jails.
In terms of vaccination?
Vaccination and just response to the pandemic.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, very mixed. And so in some cases, you know, well, let me start by saying this. We have a limited window, right? Limited insight into prisons. And part of the problem here is that there's just a very little sort of cooperation or interest in being extraordinarily transparent to help us understand what's happening. And so what I mean by that is some states started publishing dashboards to show infections and case rates kind of right away. Some states lagged behind. None of the states, as far as I'm aware of, are publishing information on race. So we don't have an understanding of the racial disparities in terms of deaths or positive cases in prisons, right? And this, and we know that the big story here for the pandemic has been about how communities of color have been disproportionately affected, right? And so we don't have a sense of that in prisons. And so, like I said at the top, some states went ahead and did widespread testing, and that proved to be a really important tool. It meant that, you know, if they were transferring people or moving folks around or quarantining people, they really had a sense of who was asymptomatic but still potentially carrying and transmitting the virus. Other states didn't do that. And, you know, we heard, like Chris said, that quarantines were very mixed. In some cases, I heard, in, you know, from federal prisoners that they were being quarantined before release with multiple other people, right? And as soon as someone came back and tested positive in their quarantine, they had to start their 14 days over again. And that's just an incredibly stressful situation if you're on your way out the door, you know, waiting to be released, and then you find out, oh my goodness, someone here in my quarantine is positive. So there was just really a wide range. And when it comes to vaccines, right, a handful of states prioritized people in prison right away. You know, they were in the first phase of the vaccine rollout. But there are still a few states for which we have little information or little understanding about where incarcerated people are going to fall. You know, we're looking at, it sounds like Florida sort of has just started, Texas, Arkansas, sort of lagging behind. But they were, you know, we're year into the pandemic now. And so each state was able to make their sort of own plan. In some cases, there was tremendous political and public pushback once word got out that incarcerated people were going to be prioritized. And so, you know, the rollout, you know, each system is sort of doing the best that they can, but it's very mixed across the country.
Well, and just explain some of the challenges around getting reliable data when you're trying to report out what's happening.
Sure. So we've been collecting data on cases since March of last year. Once we understood, you know, like Dr. Ventner said, you know, prisons are congregate settings, we were very worried that this virus would spread incredibly rapidly. And so we, you know, the Marshall Project and the Associated Press are contacting every single state prison system as well as federal prison system each week to say, give us your case numbers. Tell us how many people have been vaccinated. Tell us how many staff have been infected. And I'd say that the staff information is actually more spotty, sort of less reliable. In some cases, they're saying, well, we don't actually test staff on site. We send them out to get tested in like a CVS or, you know, at their doctor. And so we're not reporting that information. Or, you know, we'll say, well, we allow staff to get vaccinated in a community setting, so we're not tracking that either. And so it just is so hard to make determinations about what policies were followed, you know, if the practices were right, what's really happening if we don't have good data. Like, that is the sort of starting point premise for all of this. And so, like I said, that racial data sort of missing, something that we've been asking for. The COVID-19 prison project actually released a scorecard for all systems about, you know, their data transparency. Could we get it in a timely fashion? Is it accurate? You know, are there statistical issues here? And pretty much every system failed. You know, they got an F. They're just not doing it.
I want to add one more voice to the conversation. Jennifer Kinsley joins us now. She's a law professor at Northern Kentucky University. She's also an attorney practicing in Kentucky and Ohio. And Jennifer, you reached out to us last month as part of our COVID-19 remembrances to talk about one of your clients. And I want to start by playing that voicemail.
I'm a lawyer, and I wanted to remember one of my clients, Pat Sanborn, who died in prison of COVID-19. Pat had been on death row in Kentucky for about 30 years, and in the 20 years that I've known him, his heart had really softened and changed. He left behind no family and very few people who care about him, and so I feel an honor and responsibility to carry on his legacy and remember him as someone that COVID took from us.
Jennifer, can you tell us about the circumstances leading up to Pat's death, when he found out he contracted the virus, and what kind of medical attention he received?
Yes, I can. Although my understanding of his progression with the virus is somewhat limited because I was relegated to learning about it from the prison itself and not from Pat. He had contracted the virus and was hospitalized, and I did get a phone call from another attorney working on the case who had spoken with the prison warden. She informed us that Pat was hospitalized and had tested positive for COVID, but at that point he couldn't have any communication with us or with the outside world, and the next thing we learned was that he had passed away alone in the hospital.
You represent a lot of clients in Kentucky and Ohio who are currently incarcerated. What's been the range of experiences your clients have had during the pandemic over the last year?
So my clients' experiences have been relatively mixed and largely bad. There have been the obvious health issues related to clients contracting COVID. In addition to Pat, who passed away, I also represent a client who is suffering from what I think we've come to understand as long COVID, the sort of prolonged, pervasive symptoms that simply don't go away. I've had other clients test positive and recover in kind of the normal or standard fashion. But in addition to that, clients who have not tested positive for COVID have still suffered from the conditions that arise in prisons as they try to accommodate quarantining those who have tested positive. So, for example, I've had clients who have had to relocate to new dorm rooms on a moment's notice. I've had clients sleeping for a long period of time on the floor. I've had clients miss meals because the prisons can't bring all of the inmates at one time into the cafeteria, and so on. There have also been extreme communication difficulties. I personally have not seen any one of my clients since last February. It's been difficult to set up secure phone conversations. I know families have had difficulty contacting their clients, or I'm sorry, their family members who are in prison. And it's just been a very difficult time for everyone.
Well, let's play this message we got from Alex in Virginia Beach.
I got out of prison just about a year ago, right before the pandemic, and the conditions there were absolutely horrendous. They were never given soap, any of the inmates, to wash their hands with. People were incredibly cramped together in tight spaces, and even just normal diseases like the cold and the flu were incredibly common and swept through the facilities. I've stayed in contact with some of my friends who are still in there, and it basically has not improved very much at all during this pandemic. And I live in terror that one of them is going to get this disease and possibly die. I mean, there's a lot of old people in these prisons and other vulnerable ones.
We also got this tweet from Dr. Cross, who says inmates are human, too, regardless of why they are there. The Department of Corrections must have better health protocols in place. Guards and staff infected the inmates. To be infected and be treated as less than is unacceptable. If you make them work and taxpayer money funding, they should be vaccinated. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
we as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
Now let's get back to our conversation about COVID-19 and corrections facilities. I want to get to another voicemail. Here's what Joseph in Roy, Washington shared with us.
So I got locked up during the middle of the pandemic about July last year, 2020. And the guards and the inmates seemed to have no regards to wearing masks, and it seemed to be blatantly disregarding of anyone's health. The guards did not enforce it unless you were in front of the judge. I found that to be a little bit strange, but I got out without getting anything, so I guess it could be worse.
Dr. Venters, we got this tweet from Hugh, who says, what are the moral implications of delaying vaccinations for those who are incarcerated or detained? I am sure there is an attitude that criminals or undocumented immigrants have abdicated their right to vaccination and health care. How do you respond to that?
I agree that this is a real abdication. I mean, science has told us from the beginning of this outbreak that these are congregate settings, that the virus spreads like wildfire through congregate settings, whether it's a nursing home or a jail. And so our failure state by state to identify these places as priorities for vaccination is really a blatant and ongoing example of racism in health. So there's no other way to describe it.
And what do you say to people who say, why do we care about vaccinating people who are incarcerated?
Well, I think that there are many, many reasons to care. I think that, first of all, these are congregate settings that hold people in them, and those people have a right to health care that's constitutionally guaranteed. And so having science that tells us that there's a rationale, a scientific rationale, for prioritizing vaccine in these places and not following that is just pure bigotry. But beyond that, we also have an interest as a nation in ending this the effects of this pandemic. And that cannot happen if we have 5,000 jails and prisons around the country where we do not promote vaccination of all the staff and all the people held in those places.
Nicole, you've conducted studies about attitudes towards the vaccine among people who are incarcerated. What have you found?
Yeah, so we wanted to know, you know, what the prevalence of vaccine hesitancy might be behind bars. And so we reached out to people who are incarcerated via their families and asked them several different questions. And what we found overall was that for many people, this year locked up in the pandemic has been so difficult, just incredibly stressful, right? Lack of programming. They haven't been able to see their families. Their educational classes are canceled. No visitors, no volunteers. That many people are actually interested in the vaccine. They see it as an opportunity to potentially get the prison back to normal. And I think Chris pointed this out, that in his case, the staff are saying, you know, you want visitation back, you want to get this prison open, take this shot, right? And at the same time, I want to be really clear that there still is a tremendous amount of hesitancy. People do not trust the prison administrations. They have had historically a very negative experience interacting with the nurses or the doctors behind bars. And so there are real concerns that, say, they were to have a negative reaction to the vaccine, that they might be left to languish in their cells. Or in some cases, they're saying they don't actually trust the medical staff to properly refrigerate or transport or administer the virus. And in some cases, they have latched on to conspiracy theories or information. In some cases, guards are sort of stoking fears to say, oh, well, you know, somebody died when they got vaccinated, or, you know, there's a microchip in it. And so without the ability to really do that research on their own, you know, verify the reports that they're hearing, there's still a lot of confusion and concern. And many outside organizations are trying to really give incarcerated people just, you know, science-backed, neutral information to help them make a decision for themselves.
Well, you mentioned corrections staff, and this is a group you also polled. What did they share with you about their thoughts about the vaccine?
So overall, what we're seeing across the country is that many corrections officers are declining or resisting the vaccine kind of at higher rates than we would expect. And so this is a group of people, just like incarcerated people, who have seen the kind of very worst of the pandemic. They've watched people fall ill, they've watched people die. And so it's a little perplexing to you know, as to why they're saying, well, I'm not interested. And so there are a couple reasons we teased out or we sussed out. One being that correctional officers tend to overwhelmingly be, you know, white, male, may have less education. And so national polls have sort of shown us that this demographic, this group of people, tends to have the highest rate of vaccine hesitancy or disinterest. In some cases, people have also latched on to conspiracy theories, you know, that have circulated on social media. And they're very concerned about, you know, that the sort of potential side effects here that it's important to point out, you know, aren't real. There are not nano chips. You know, this is not a conspiracy by, you know, the powers that be to control people. But those ideas have really permeated in some of these groups. And then you have people who are just sort of hesitant. They want to let others kind of go first. They're, you know, they say the vaccine was rushed or they don't have all of their answers yet. And so it's really a wide range. But it just, you know, correctional officers are the primary pathway that the virus spreads both inside and outside. And so figuring out how to incentivize and get these folks vaccinated has become really important for some of these systems. So, for example, in Colorado, they're now giving a $500 bonus to correctional officers who get vaccinated.
Well, I want to get to one more voicemail. Here's what one of you had to say about working in a corrections facility.
My name is Kate from Maryland. I worked in juvenile corrections. A majority of our inmates were between the ages of 12 and 16. And throughout the pandemic, we saw a lot of scaling back of visitation, which, especially when you have young children, it's really difficult. Well, young children and teenagers, it's really difficult with behavioral issues when they are unable to see their moms or dads or loved ones or caseworkers for an extended period of time. Unfortunately, until there is a vaccine that is approved, children under 18, we're not going to be able to vaccinate any of our kids. And I'm afraid that when that is available, we're going to be seeing a lot of pushback from both the inmates and their families and even employees themselves.
We also got this email from one of you who says, I'm the mother of someone currently in a federal U.S. penitentiary in Texas, where they have the whole population in 24/7 lockdown and no one has been outside for over a year. Not one breath of fresh air, not a ray of sunshine. Jennifer, how do your clients feel about the vaccine? And for those who'd like to receive it, how many of them have been vaccinated so far?
That's a great question. My clients are largely excited and hopeful about the potential of the vaccine. They do want to be able to see their families in person and not be relegated to a computer screen for visitation. And they do want to feel like they are healthy and safe while they are incarcerated. But as the other speakers have mentioned, their access to information is very limited. They know very little about the vaccines and how they'll be distributed. They are skeptical of prison medical care in general because our prison medical care is largely substandard. So I think there is a gap there in terms of needing to educate clients to make sure they understand that the vaccine is safe and also to make sure that the vaccine is available to them so that they can resume some sense of normalcy.
Well, we got this tweet from Tony who says, I am a correctional officer with the Tennessee Department of Correction. Just recently, they announced that people visiting inmates can sign up to get a vaccination at the prison. Dr. Venters, why isn't the vaccine mandatory in all corrections facilities for both staff and people who are incarcerated?
Well, I think that we don't generally in public health mandate vaccine access, except for in a very few, like for instance, hospitals sometimes for health staff will mandate it. And there are some places where individual jails or prisons have mandated it either for correctional or health staff. But I think that the critical shortcoming here is really around engagement. We haven't used tools that we use everywhere else in the country to promote uptake of this vaccine, specifically among correctional staff. And so this notion that we have, you know, a lot of correctional staff are earning In some of the places I have been, the same that you would earn working in the Dollar General store. They're working in a place where the administrators haven't figured out how they can easily get the vaccine, who's going to pay for the time for them to go get that vaccine, and then if they have a side effect, do they have to take sick time or vacation time, some of their own time off, just because they get this vaccine? And so those are basic interventions that we need to implement to promote uptake of the vaccine. We also need to rely on credible messengers. Who are the people that are trusted by correctional staff and by detained people to give this message that we're talking about with the, you know, the benefits of the vaccine? And so for me, the lack of those basic public health measures is much more critical than whether we mandate or don't mandate, because I've seen them be effective in lots of jails and prisons, and it's what we need to do everywhere.
We got this tweet from Elizabeth, who says, if a college were to house thousands of students in close quarters during the pandemic and not provide enough vaccines, people would be outraged. But that's exactly what's happening in our jails and prisons, and few people know or care. Shows how inmates are viewed as second-class citizens. And Sarah emailed, my nephew is incarcerated in Michigan and contracted COVID-19 at the end of December. During that time, he was cut off from all of his life-saving medications that he was supposed to receive every day. I had to contact legislators and other government agencies to get the correctional facility to provide him his heart hypertension medications. He was without his asthma inhalers for over a month. I had to attach emails from my nephew to correspondence with the senator's office in order for the prison to give him his head inhalers. He has suffered from asthma his entire life. Nicole, I want to turn to another issue beyond vaccines. There's also the issue for testing. And how much are you able to gather data about how much testing is being done in corrections facilities?
Sure. So, you know, every week we're going to these facilities to ask them about the number of positive cases, about the number of tests conducted. And so what we've seen over the course of a year of doing this is that there are sort of moments in which facilities decide that it's really important for them to conduct widespread testing. But by no means is this a strategy that has been sustained across the entire pandemic. And it seems like in moments when they feel, oh, perhaps we're in the clear, the testing sort of trickles down and people are only getting tested based on having symptoms, right? So this is in the case where you're having trouble breathing, it seems very clear that you might have COVID and you're able to get testing. In some cases, I just heard from California that in some prisons, many people were recently vaccinated and are now being retested. And someone had a question of why is that important? And I think many of these systems have learned a very hard lesson, California in particular, when they're moving people around and deciding that they can keep transfers open and whether that means transferring people from the jail into the prisons or transferring people from prisons to other prisons. That to do that without really clear information about who is potentially positive has meant that the has fueled outbreaks in some of these systems. And so, you know, it seems like California is trying to sort of address that issue. But testing is really mixed. At the start of the pandemic, just like, you know, on outside of prison, testing was extraordinarily limited. There just was not a lot of access. And so I think we can be very clear that we've missed a number of cases. The numbers we have are good. They're what we have, but they are most likely an undercount.
Dr. Venters, post-pandemic, and even while we're still in the midst of it, there are lots of people trying to figure out what lessons we need to learn from what's happened with COVID-19. What do you hope we learn about how to protect incarcerated people and people who work at prisons and jails so that we can better protect people the next time there's a public health crisis?
I think for me, the central lesson of this experience is that we have to put healthcare and health outcomes behind bars together with the rest of our nation, because they've been so clearly cut away. And so what that means is the CDC needs to have an ongoing role in both tracking and promoting better health outcomes for people with justice involvement. State departments of health who do this and look at hospitals and nursing homes, they also need to be involved in this, because we have seen how woefully impossible it is for correctional administrators to just jump into a public health emergency with a little bit of technical assistance on the fly from those organizations. And so for me, my central hope right now is that we craft an ongoing and sustained role for the CDC and state departments of health in promoting health and overseeing the adequacy of healthcare behind bars.
Nicole, where do you think Dr. Venter's concerns might bump up against politics?
Sure. I mean, I will say that, you know, in my reporting, I saw as vaccinations were rolling out just how many conservative, you know, radio shows, talk shows really politicized this issue and said, you know, criminals are being vaccinated before your grandma. And so I think that those attitudes that really animate this conversation are really important. And so there might be some pushback, some hesitancy.
Well, thanks to Dr. Homer Venters, a physician and epidemiologist. He's also a member of the Biden-Harris COVID-19 Health Equity Task Force. And Nicole Lewis, a staff writer for the Marshall Project. That's a nonprofit news organization covering the U.S. criminal justice system. Dr. Venters, Nicole, thank you for your time. Today's producer was Catherine Fink. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.